This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alice Garner, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Jean Hotman about her new book, Surviving Emotional Work for Teachers, Improving Wellbeing and Professional Learning Through Reflexive Practice, published in 2020 by Routledge. Dr. Hotman is a lecturer and researcher in initial teacher education at Victoria University in Melbourne, Australia. She has taught and counselled in diverse educational settings, including government schools, private schools, international schools, alternative education settings and universities. Storytelling is at the heart of the work that you've been doing, Jean, so I thought I'd tell a little story of how I come to be interviewing you before I ask about your story. So the year that you published an article in The Conversation about teachers' emotional work not being recognised, I think it was in 2017, and I was teaching high school at that time, and I remember seeing the article and it really struck a chord with me. And I knew you vaguely from the sidelines of our son's football teams, and I thought, oh, I'd really like to have a conversation with Jean about this at some stage. And I think we may have had a very brief chat one day about it. But then the book came out, and by that time I had actually left teaching. And it was a conversation I still wanted to have. So having signed up to be a host on this New Books in Education podcast, I thought this is a good one to start with. It's something that, you know, I think is really important and that perhaps doesn't get acknowledged enough. So for me, it was sort of an opportunity to have that conversation that we never really had, but in a more public forum, I suppose. So I guess the first question I wanted to ask you was, what led you to write this book? And perhaps to explain something of why storytelling and narrative inquiry has been such an important part of this project for you.
Yeah, Maurice, thank you for having me, Alice, and I'm glad we can have this conversation today. I had, you know, in your intro you sort of described I've taught in a range of different settings. I started in 2000 in a private school. I went into a registered training organisation and was the director of literacy and numeracy, developing programs for often very marginalised and disadvantaged young people. I have worked at an international school overseas in the United Arab Emirates, and have worked in an alternative education setting here back in Melbourne, working with, again, marginalised young women. And in all of those settings, I recognize the emotional work that was required. Didn't matter, you know, whether from the, you know, the private school or the international school, which was, you know, very well resourced compared to education settings working with, you know, young people with really very complex and difficult circumstances. And I mean, I think we work with young people with a whole range of needs in every setting. So I recognise that there was this common thread of emotional work through all of those settings, but I suppose it's the first story that I start with, which is the story of Stephen in the book, which, you know, was early on in my teaching career, and you know, Stephen was this young person that I just found really difficult to teach, and I found it really difficult to establish a relationship with Stephen. And I recognised it at the time, and I couldn't quite figure out why. And you know, it was just because he was difficult. But I also did have this understanding that other students who were also difficult, I could still develop a relationship with. And it wasn't until about 8 years, I think it was 8 years after teaching Stephen, and I was having a conversation with a group of colleagues, you know, at a reunion, and we're talking about, you know, back in the day and the different students that we taught, and I had, you know, sort of been constantly thought about Stephen throughout that 8 years. You know, Stephen would pop back into my mind, and I, you know, sort of inquired about Stephen. If anyone knew, you know, where he was at, what he was up to. And I had mentioned that I just found it really hard to teach Stephen. And all, I recognised that all of the other teachers also found Stephen difficult but talked about him fondly. And I sort of thought, well, that's a bit strange. You know, like I was the only one that really struggled to find the attachment, you know, in a teacher student relationship, or to be, you know, yeah, connected I had definitely sort of through that conversation recognized that I had kept Stephen at a distance for some reason. And I suppose that conversation then led me to think, well, what was happening for me at that time? And I realized that it was also at a time in my life that was very difficult, and I was facing the prospects of, you know, infertility and never becoming a mother. And I talk about in the book that, you know, Stephen's difficult behaviour required this type of mothering that I think that I had distanced myself from. And so, you know, and I sort of did a lot of thinking about that myself and a lot of conversational work. And then through, it was also probably at the same time I had undertaken, you know, a postgraduate study in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and thinking about that, the context and, you know, human development and, you know, attachment theory and a whole range of, you know, sort of, yeah, work around relationships probably enlightened me a little bit. And I thought, I wonder, you know, now that I have these new tools in my toolkit, I wonder how they can be, you know, utilised in a teaching framework. And so that's what sort of led to the research and that element of emotion being significant, I think. But something, it was clearly there, and it was clearly, you know, there was a lot going on, but we just didn't have the tools really to talk about it or to think about it as teacher professionals. And so I thought, I wonder what could happen if we did have those tools.
So tell me about the next steps. You undertook this research as part of a doctorate, is that right? Was it the same project that has kind of been turned now into a book, or were there other steps?
Yeah, so it was the doctoral research. So the book is a result of the doctoral research, and I've published a couple of other pieces, the teacher emotional rules sort of, you know, and that methodology behind that in a chapter in another book. And I also explored reflexivity in research as an ethical tool as well. So this is all stemmed from the doctoral research, really. And I just felt like it was, you know, this stuff sits in a thesis somewhere, and I really wanted to try to find a way to get it to teachers. I'm not saying that it's, you know, absolutely vital for every single teacher, but if it helps, you know, a teacher, three teachers, some teachers, a group of teachers, then, you know, it's worth it.
So we might come back to that later about where you see this heading. But I'd like to know more about the methodology you chose, the teacher researchers that you worked with, how that unfolded and how your approach kind of evolved over that time.
Yes, it was very emerging. I think actually from the beginning I was really wanting to explore the teacher-student relationship and, you know, because that the story of Stephen was, very much focused on the relationship between teacher and student. And then I sort of thought when I started to look into that a little bit more, it's a huge, huge topic, of course, but I thought there is no real understanding, and this was my experience as well, there is no real understanding of the relationship until you can understand yourself, you know, until you can understand you in that experience or in that moment. And so reflexivity became a really important part of the research. So I then thought, well, it's about teacher reflexivity. So I needed to work in depth with teachers. I knew I wanted it to be in a single school so that we could start to look at or, you know, try to gain some sense of a collective of teachers that understand, have some sort of understanding of each other's predicament and the experiences that they might have. And to start off with, I approached the school and, you know, said, look, this is what I want to explore, which is the emotional, you know, aspects of teaching. And I would like to do that through participatory action research to begin with. That was what I was focusing on. To begin with, I would, you know, would start with some background interviews with the participants, but that it would be a involve group conversations and, you know, I think I had about a maximum of 10 over a year. I had the question of, you know, how can emotional consciousness impact teacher agency? So I was focusing on teacher agency, and can reflexivity, you know, support teacher agency? And basically the first three teachers that popped up their hands and went, yeah, sure, this sounds interesting, I'd like to explore, became the first group of teachers that I worked with. And so with that group of teachers, we went through one cycle, which was, you know, like a cycle of reconnaissance, just to figure out, what their stories of emotion were. So there were sort of two background interviews I actually sort of probed into, you know, so what emotions do you typically feel, you know, what experiences might lead to them, what do you think the catalyst is, and those sorts of more specific questions. And then after that we went into what we called a collaborative inquiry process, and to begin with the teachers, and I worked one-to-one. So I worked individually with those three teachers to begin with in that first cycle. And we actually started with, because it's pretty hard, we're not very well poised to to talk about emotion in Western society and to sort of, you know, just lay it out there. So we actually used I encouraged the teachers, they could bring a story of their own, or that if they wanted, they could bring a media story, whatever media story that, you know, sort of struck them as being important. And they would come to the session, and we'd start with the story. Okay, what story did you bring? And we'd talk about the story, and then we'd talk about, you know, okay, so, you know, what sort of emotion do we think is, you know, underlying this story? And then the next stage would sort of be, you know, would always connect to their work. So, and I'm talking about stories like, there was one story I recall, it was back when Tony Abbott threatened to shirt front Putin. I don't know, you know. And the teacher had brought this story in and was talking about, you know, how the, you know, just the, how bizarre, you know, what an outrageous thing to do, like this, you know, puffing of the chest and, you know, this aggression. And then the conversation unfolded and it changed into talking about power and the power dynamics within the school and, you know, between staff and between students and teachers and, you know, and you know, masculinity and that kind of thing. So it sort of would start with a news, you know, a media story, but it would sort of always end up back in the school focus. And another news story was about a teacher, you know, who had read a story, a really, really difficult and terrible story of murder suicide with young children, and talking about some, you know, that sort of shifted into a school setting and talking about how difficult it can be seeing, you know, some of the students that we teach suffer in different circumstances, whether it's through, you know, could be, you know, difficult home circumstances or, you know, financial barriers or a whole range of things. That's how it started, that first cycle. And through that first cycle, basically I was just analysing it to try to find the how the narratives unfolded. Well, actually, at that time, it wasn't until that first cycle that I went, narrative inquiry is actually absolutely vital to this piece of research. I was initially focusing on the action, you know, what would happen, but really it's the process was really important as well, and narrative inquiry captures that. And so the stories, I wanted to then try to explore basically the shifts in the stories, how they flowed and what might lead to, you know, a closing down of a story and what might lead to, you know, a deeper sort of inquiry. And through that first cycle of action, then we went into the second cycle of action, and we had a little bit of a structure that we were ready to then trial. So through the conversations with the teachers, you know, we were sharing our stories. Then I would we'd talk about, okay, so I've noticed that, you know, it's really important to a lot of the talk is about what we're doing wrong. Or what's wrong, and, you know, actually, is it important to think of the strengths and those sorts of things? And so we had those sorts of conversations as well. And by the second cycle, then we had a little bit of a structure to trial as a group. So then we came together as a group and we trialed that structure. The teachers by that stage were sort of feeling comfortable to start bringing, we didn't need the media stories anymore. Some took more time with the media stories, and others actually went, actually, I don't need a media story at all. Here's a story. And then this, yeah, that second cycle was we were ready to come together and start sharing stories. But of course, also as time goes on, there's a whole lot of building trust that needed to happen as well. And then the third cycle was actually when a group of three new teachers came in. So the first group of teachers had moved on to facilitating the collaborative inquiry process on their own, and I really just became an observer. And the third cycle was also that opportunity for that second group of new teachers, hadn't, you know, engaged in the research as yet, to then trial this structure that the first group had developed, because it might work for them, but it might not work for a new group. So, you know, we trialed it with the new group.
Oh, that's interesting, because later on in the book you talk about working out ways to incorporate this kind of process into a professional learning kind of program or something similar, and I did have a question about, you know, you mentioned that the teachers had said they felt they needed a facilitator or facilitation, and I was curious to know about how that might evolve, like, you know, would they be trained or, but it's interesting that it sort of comes out of that process that someone might then feel equipped to guide another group through that process.
Yeah, and that was all negotiated as well. Like, some people felt more confident to facilitate, and others were, you know, sort of happy to not facilitate. Actually, in the article I wrote, and we talked, I talk about the opportunity to facilitate sort of became a bit of a reflexive experience for me in a way, in trying to guide this research, because, you know, there was a participant who was hesitant to research because they felt that their voice was often privileged, and so they sort of held back, and, you know, so yeah, it was all very negotiated, and the teacher researchers, you know, drove the project, and like I said, and it emerged. So when I first started, I didn't actually, you know, in the book I talk about the teacher emotional rules, which I think have become really important and central to the research, but I didn't start out actually looking for that at all. I didn't start out searching for particular emotions. I didn't name any emotions to begin with. I sort of let the teachers just, their experiences spoke for themselves, and then I just went back through and analysed it and just, you know, sort of picked out through the thematic analysis the emotions that they were talking about.
I was really interested to see that at the top of the list of the emotions that you list as notable emotions or ones that emerged in various ways through the stories was defeat. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Yes, I can. I think that it's a strange word to use for an emotion to begin with, and I did grapple over what word I should use. It's a little bit, and I think I talk about how Turner talks about shame, and it is very similar, but it's not quite the same. And it's there's the struggle. It's tied up in the struggle. And in every story, and there were something like 44 different stories, like I've written about, you know, my own and then six others. There was definitely this struggle. There was this pervading, you know, sense of defeat. And there was this magic line that either was, going to be crossed or not crossed, or, you know, but it was sort of there implied in all of the stories. And I think that the reason defeat is inherent in life. Like we are all struggling. We are all, you know, and sometimes it's more of a struggle. Sometimes it's striving, and sometimes we feel like we're thriving. So, and I also, you know, did want to, you know, the title of the book, Surviving, is that good enough? Should it be thriving? Thriving in emotional way. But it does, that surviving, you know, I think needed to be there because it's about, you know, surviving the struggle. And that was sort of what was central through the teacher's stories. And I think the other is that contentment and defeat were both very high up, and that they are both very tied up into each other. And I do think, I suspect that defeat possibly, you know, there is a chance that it was spoken about more because we ended up being in this very, you know, scenario or group that could be trusted with these difficult stories. So they're more likely the stories to be shared. Whereas it's pretty easy to go into a staff room and talk about that. Oh yeah, I've had a great day, and oh yeah, this wonderful thing happened, and you know, you can share those stories easily and with a range of people. And I suppose in the space that we'd created, the teachers may have you know recognized, well, this is a space where I can talk about those other stories that I can't really talk about there. So I think that could be part of it as well. But I think – go, Alice.
Sorry, yeah, you described them as difficult to share stories.
Yeah, difficult to share, definitely.
Yeah, and it got me thinking too. I mean, as I looked through – before I'd read the whole book, but when I just looked at the chapters, and each chapter is based on one story, and immediately I felt that I could – connect with each of those stories. And then as I read the book, I thought, wow, you know, it's almost like they're almost like archetypal stories in some way, that any teacher will have some version of that experience. But then I began to wonder whether it was those stories that somehow just sit in your belly somewhere, that you're feeling like, I haven't really sorted that one out. It's still hovers there somewhere. And I wonder if, you know, that brings in a sort of sense of the bodily expressions of emotion too. You know, occasionally if you're rushing through a school day, you don't have time to work out what it is that's creating that feeling.
Definitely. And it is. It was sort of, we talked about that. It's sort of like that the stories that were stuck, you know, you would churn over them, or they'd sit in your gut, or and then even when they're talking about the stories, you know, in the stories there's language like feeling gobsmacked and, you know, just really you physically felt, you know, and it's stuck. There was often this stuck feeling. And so it sort of became a space to talk about these or share these stories to help unstick them, I guess. But I do think that also there were plenty of stories that were shared that were also the sorts of stories that you know, might happily share in a staff room. And I think I give an example in the book about a teacher who, you know, says, comes in and says, oh, this really awesome thing happened today, and, you know, would talk about this really awesome thing that happened. But even in those really awesome stories, there was still often a question of, oh, was that the right thing to do though? Should have I done that? If I did that, if I treated that student, you know, of this really awesome thing, and I've, you know, like maybe expressed, you know, real pride in this particular student, have I left another student out, or did I, you know? I think that, and that is really why, I think the structure unfolded the way it did, like I said earlier, in that identifying that the strengths as being really important to the process.
Did you find that you and the teacher researchers you worked with, did they come out of the end of this process, which presumably they might continue in some form, but with a sense that they had been able to process or move on or make sense of those stories?
So the feedback from the teachers was that the process was really helpful in understanding the stories. And they all talked about, like, while in the book it looks like, you know, there was a story and then there was a whole bunch of discussion that happened after that story, in actual fact, these narratives that have been pulled together actually may have unfolded over a year. So, you know, because I met with the teachers repeatedly, even with the second group, I met with them probably over 6 months, but I still met with them repeatedly. And what tended to happen is that while the stories in the book are, you know, an individual, you know, like story, that they would resurface in later meetings. So at the start of a session, a teacher would share a story, and then everybody else's stories is going to center around that one story. But even though it still centers around that one story, there were still ways in which the teachers would cycle back to their, you know, a story that they might have shared, you know, 3 weeks ago or a month ago or whatever. And some of those same themes that they would keep exploring. So it was, there were, for each of the teachers, there were things that they were working through and specific things that they were working through. And it actually didn't matter so much what the initial starting story was in the session. They would still be working through their own things, if that makes sense. And so the narratives that have been pulled together are actually based on, so I've got the initial story at the start of each chapter, and then the quotes that follow are often the quotes and the revelations they've had about that story, but later on, and it could have been, you know, months later on, where they've cycled back to, hey, you remember that story about blah, and I just thought the other day, blah, 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 blah. And in the debrief interviews, when I sort of went back and said, okay, so now let's have a think about the, you know, the process and, you know, what your thoughts of it are, all of the teachers thought that it was, well, and I mean, they used things like it, that it was almost therapeutic and cathartic and that they felt calmer and more relaxed and helpful in those kinds of ways. But there were also, they did talk about conditions for it to be successful in a school as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, actually, on that, let's think a little bit about the terms that you use to differentiate different types of stories. I'm thinking of the secret, the sacred stories, actually, the secret and the cover stories, and sort of tied in with that, the observation that you made about certain emotions being considered, well, not ones that you would want to name or that somehow are seen as sort of a sign that you're not being professional or, you know, and I see those things as all sort of intertwined, but I'd love to hear a bit more about your thoughts on that.
Oh, I think you're completely on the money there, Alice. They are all intertwined and it's very hard to, you know, and I think that one of the things that I've found the trickiest is in separating it out, I don't want to minimize any element of, you know, of teachers' work, really. I don't think it's easy to grasp and to talk about. And really, they. So I've tried to sort of think of these elements, but in a collective sense as well, for the person and a group of people and the culture that they sit within. But I think that the, yeah, so, and I think Parker's story is a really good example of the, you know, the hiding and or faking emotions that might be necessary for teachers to undertake their work. And if, you know, drawing on the work of Ali Hochschild-Russell and the, you know, emotional rules, the real issue is that we all employ emotional rules. There's, you know, cultural context for us to employ emotional rules. And when we do so naturally, it's not an issue. It's when we have these, what we would call the sacred stories, sort of overarching the work that we do, then we, you know, are going to necessarily employ culturally constructed rules, but rules that may, you know, oppose our what we would normally respond emotionally. So, and what I mean by those sacred stories is the, you know, what we say should be happening. What an effective teacher should do, what effective schools should do, best practice, and these sorts of, which I'm not saying we shouldn't have these things, but when we have, there are certain circumstances, and, you know, talk about the long list of what teachers should do, and it's sort of growing and becoming more fine-tuned and, you know, more task-oriented, and that autonomy becomes reduced. And it's not just autonomy in your action, what you can do, it's how you feel, you know, how you can emote. And, yeah, Parker's story of I'm not really that frightened, but I'm, you know, from this student who's been violent in my class and, you know, who is often violent in my class, but I'm going to backpedal away from the student and that kind of thing. So they're sort of an example of Parker conjuring up the confidence or trust that they might need in to have in a student, because you can't show fear in a classroom, you know. And the teachers talked about that. Oh no, you can't ever show them fear, otherwise they know they've got control. And you know, it's that power and control, right and wrong, you know, and having these definite barriers to being who you are, to being human, are there. You know, it's like I suppose the teachers often feel like they have to be like robots in a way and detach themselves from who they really are, to remain that hardline professional.
Yeah, and there's that sense that you are being watched by a whole classroom of students when you're having that interaction, aren't you? So that, you know, there's all sorts of kind of thoughts going on simultaneously about how do I respond to this individual without losing face or whatever it might be, or losing control of the class more broadly. Yeah, there's so many elements. And I thought it was interesting, actually, you suggested that in some of those situations, and I think I've got the words written here, natural warning mechanisms are shut down. So that actually in some ways, yeah, you are having to make unsafe choices in order to keep this whole thing,
yeah, it's like,
appearing professional or something. Yeah.
It's like nothing to see here. We're just, you know, business as usual. And then, yeah, because, and it, you know, like there's the different levels of the surface acting that we might employ, and that would be considered not particularly harmful, because you're conscious of it. You know, it's at the surface. And teachers would talk about, you know, in the research, teachers would talk about that they might, you know, they might fake really liking a student, and you know, they might struggle with that student, but they know, you know, it's at a surface. They might hide, you know, anger. But they know they're hiding that anger. I'm really ticked off with that student, but oh, okay, this is okay, you know, and they know. But it's that deep acting that can be really harmful. And, yeah, I mean, in a lot of different, not just the teacher education research, but also just in mental health research, you know, that those avoidant coping mechanisms are harmful. And it's sort of what we're suggesting teachers need to employ in a way, because, you know, we do have these very rigid expectations of how teachers should react in classrooms, that they should remain calm no matter what. I mean, you know, even the thinking of the story of being in the midst of muck up day. You know, if any teacher's been in the midst of muck up day, I don't know that calm is the right the right word that you could use to describe that moment.
Yeah, I have a very strong memory of being on one side of a glass sliding door with year 12 students on the other side, you know, throwing stuff, and seeing in the crowd kids that I taught and knew and liked, but knowing I had to be the no, you can't come in person, and yet at the same time feeling that this was such an important day for them to kind of, you know, the world upside down and all of that. So, yeah, really spoke to me. There was an interesting choice. I mean, look, we could keep exploring that the stories and the acting and all. There are so many layers and elements. But I did want to ask you a little bit about a choice that you made, which was to use the pronoun they and not choose non-gender specific names for your teachers. Could you tell me why you made that choice? Because I think that's, you know, that's quite unusual. At least it. Well, maybe not so much now, but, you know, this is a new development, I'd say.
There were two reasons, actually, and one was because the group of teachers was so small that if I identified them by gender, the teachers, you know, were known to have volunteered for this project. So if I had used the gender, then I think there was a strong possibility that some of the teachers would have been identified through that. So it was to protect their identity, number one. The other was that, you know, I talk about the script for you know, living for ourselves and how that is that evolves, that we influence it, and that's, you know, social context influences the script at the same time. And in Riley's story, I thought that that was a significant moment to highlight that, because that's the story, you know, there's a story where Riley, the teacher, teaching a class, you know, students start talking about, oh, you know, Riley, teacher, you could have a relationship with this other teacher. And one of the students, and Riley says, oh, I have a boyfriend. And one of the students says, does your boyfriend have a big schlong? In the middle of the class, Riley freezes, you know, don't know what to do. But in that moment, when you read it, I think that, and I stated in the book, that people would assume Riley's gender based on that question, based on the I have a boyfriend. And there's a few moments actually in the book where, and I have had, you know, different people say to me, oh yeah, you know, that teacher is definitely male. And I sit there and think, why do you think that teacher's definitely male? And, you know, they'll explain why. And I would never say whether they are or they're not, but I am going to say that people do get it wrong. And I think that they're the underlying issues, actually, which is where I'm exploring more now, that how these sorts of social structures that we have around gender, around sexuality, around, you know, ethnicity, race, religion, how they frame the stories that we live, and that how basically, I would like to explore now the emotional work involved in exploring those sorts of contexts, and how difficult it can be difficult sometimes. And I think Riley's story is a perfect example of how difficult it can be in navigating that space and not wanting to get it wrong. But, you know, by not wanting to get it wrong, then feeling like I don't know what to do then. I don't know how to respond. So I just disengage. And that can cause, you know, a lot of barriers for teachers and students.
In the conversations that you had with the teacher researchers, was there much gender analysis along the way? I mean, I'm thinking even back to your story right at the beginning when you talked about the kind of teaching as well can be seen as a form of mothering, and even that word, you know, so those elements of sort of care work, and then the notions of professionalization of teaching, you know, thinking about how you tease those out alongside the choice to not identify people by gender. So I guess these are just some.
I know. So then there were limitations. There were that gender was race, religion, sexuality. They all were spoken about a lot, and because I then, you know, wanted to keep the teachers' identities gender neutral, then, you know, that removed the possibility. But to be honest, there's possibly another three theses in there. You know, like it's sort of quite huge, and it's why I'm sort of moving into that, you know, exploring that now. But yeah, and I do, in the thesis, I actually talk about that term mothering that I use a little bit more. And when I didn't have space to write about it in the book, but when I initially did the research, and I talk about how I Googled, you know, teachers America, teachers, you know, UK, teachers Australia. I actually did a Google image search, and back then, when I Googled teacher, the image was of a, you know, maybe late 20s to 30-year-old, attractive, thin, you know, very warm, oozing warmth kind of woman, Anglo usually, you know, well-dressed, covered up, you know. Not necessarily well dressed, but I mean, you know, collar and shirt and I thought, how interesting. And that was like, you know, you could go down for pages, and they were just the repeat image of this. And I thought, that's really interesting, isn't it? That's how we, you know, when society is telling us, you know, reflecting it back to us, this is what a teacher looks like. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't look like any of those teachers, you know, and neither does my colleague. Like, you know, men weren't really represented, you know, people with brown skin weren't represented. There was, a whole bunch of people that weren't represented. I am pleased to say I did it again not too long ago, and there was more diversity in the image of a teacher. Still probably predominantly women. But, yeah, so I think that whole idea of mothering and, you know, and being a teacher, and then if we look at our workforce, you know, if we look at the gender balance in our workforce, we're predominantly women, particularly in primary schools, and it does even out a little bit more in secondary schools.
Thinking of professional identity, that brings this in a way to possibilities in professional learning and professional development too. You know, what is it to be a good teacher, and what do we need to be working on? I think, you know, for myself, I came to teaching as a, you know, late career change teacher, and having had children myself, so sort of, you know, you come with certain experiences, life, work, home experiences that are really quite different from, say, first year out of uni in their early 20s, you know. And it always seemed to me that professional development and professional learning sessions didn't necessarily acknowledge that. There was a kind of one-size-fits-all feel to it. And it seems to me that what you're thinking about here of this collaborative inquiry-type approach opens up possibilities for people with much more varied experiences and ways of going about things to come together and nut things out. Is that what you're imagining? And can you talk a little bit about how you would like to see this process play out?
Definitely. Actually, and you're very right. Like if I think about the teachers that participated in the research, and there were several who were, you know, career changers, so had previous careers, people who had, a master's in science and different types of degrees and qualifications that they brought. They were very, yeah, I suppose different in life experiences. They were definitely not reflective of the images of the Google images of the teacher, right? They were all very different, had different experiences that they brought. And in the stories that they shared, the collaborative inquiry process sort of allows them and even encourages them to think of those other experiences external from the school. So in that process, where the first part of the collaborative inquiry process is initially a teacher sharing their story, the next part of the process is, okay, everybody in the group then thinks, you know, talks about and verbalizes, okay, the strengths. Here's the strengths in this story. And then the next part of the story is sharing perspective. So that's when the other teachers in the group don't necessarily share a different story. Like, they do share a different story, but they've got to pick a story that has a similar underlying theme to the initial story. So if the initial story, you know, had a theme where there were this set of expectations, but they were limited in this particular kind of way, and there were these particular type of feelings, then I wonder if you can think of a time when you felt, you know, when you had a similar kind of experience. And that was when a lot of the times the teachers might actually come up with the stories and experiences from past workplaces, from, you know, other relationships with friends, social, you know, clubs or whatever. And it was actually that ability to connect all of these rich sort of experiences, and to for each of the teachers to see that they're not alone, that it sort of validates their experience because it has happened elsewhere, that it does happen in other settings. Because I think this is the other thing with schools, is that schools are sort of, well, strange places in a way. They're not quite like other workplaces, and they can be quite isolated. And so, you know, to have these moments and opportunities to sort of think about their work in through another perspective and in another context is actually really important. And I think also for those teachers who did have those experiences, it was also validating for them as well. I have this other experience, and, you know, to share and to use, and it helps them, might help them connect that experience and skill and wisdom to their current predicament.
Have you looked into or tried to implement anything sort of since your work on this project within schools, or have you been sort of thinking about how that might be done? Well, you know, what are the challenges, but also what are the opportunities?
Look, I would, yes, I've sort of looked at, so that sort of the debrief interviews with the teachers really helped frame the, you know, like I said, what were the challenges and how to best structure it. I haven't gone back into a school. I would love to actually go back into a school with it. I have actually been using the process at Victoria University, actually, with staff and students as a way to explore cultural identity, actually. So sort of, like I'd sort of mentioned earlier, the ways in which our social framings might, you know, impact on how someone sees themselves and what, you know, who they can be, exploring that with university teachers and students. But I would like to get back into schools. I think COVID over the last couple of years has made that very difficult. So hopefully when we can get back into schools, maybe that is something that could be possible.
I think it would be fantastic. And I think in recent years there's been a bit of a spate of kind of corporate-style professional development things going on that are not a great fit, it seems to me, often with teachers. You know, they'll take a model from a big corporation and sort of adjust it a little bit and present it to teachers. And I had a few experiences where I thought, this is not speaking to our profession, like it doesn't understand. And part of that is that it is a care profession and it's not a profit-driven profession. So I think that, yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting possibilities that you explore. I'm just thinking about, you talk about the impossible script that teachers are supposed to follow. Now, I'm conscious that we're running out of time, but I think it's an interesting idea. And I guess I was wondering whether you think it's possible to rewrite that script or whether it's more a matter of acknowledging that it is an impossible script and that we simply have to find a way to live with it somehow.
Yeah. I think that a bit like the, you know, I talk about Riddle and Webb's wicked problems. I think education and most human service work is really, you know, they're wicked problems and that they're very, very complicated and it's not so much a solution. It's a resolution or resolution, you know, going around and around and around again. So if I'm talking about impossible and whether something is possible, you know, whether there is a solution, well, maybe not a solution, but definitely some evolution or some shifting. I think that the impossible script is impossible, and it was impossible for these teachers in a way until they understood or had an idea, a sense of those underlying expectations, the limitations and the assumptions that were driving those narratives. Once you understand where the multiple writers of the script, you know, where it's coming from, then you can feel like you have some autonomy to write the next, you know, chapter. And I think that the uniform story, Remy's story, where the teachers at the end start talking about, you know, and you think a uniform is something. In fact, I've heard it described as trivial, not that important, but actually it's really very important. I mean, for a young person, telling them what to wear is a big thing, right? But also then it's that not that different from what you were describing, Alice, and standing behind the glass on muck-up day and, you know, having to maybe tell these students off who you're sort of thinking, yeah, but they're just, you know, they're having their day. It's a bit like that, you know, depending on how you feel about uniforms and, you know, oh, do I really want to spend time, you know, picking up students on a uniform when they actually haven't had three square meals today or, you know, and those sorts of things. And they talk about, the teachers talk about that moment where they've gone, we actually do need to question something as simple as a uniform and why we're doing it and who it serves, because then that's how the script can be shifted. And I think there's also moments, Avery's story about talking with the students and, you know, that was the muck-up day the muck-up day story, and talking with the students about what had happened and being open and honest about it and having that. So I think that schools can shift the script, but it is going to take reflexivity, and whether it's the collaborative inquiry process or something like it, that is what it's going to have to take, because I think it's also the issues of, you know, the power and structure within schools, who makes the decisions, why they're made, you know, whose voices are heard, whose voices are not heard. Until we can sort of get to those deeper questions, then, maybe the script will stay as it is, but if we can, it would be great.
So posed yourself another wicked problem for the next book, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and we've just hit an hour exactly, and I think that's a good length, and I think we covered a lot of the things I wanted to ask you about, but I feel like this conversation might continue in future in other settings.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so with you too, Alice.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jean.